KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
None of us have seen anything like this. They're coming in and disrupting the lives of civil servants that have been doing this job for years.
A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration's offer of financial incentives to federal employees who agreed to resign now.
For Thursday, February 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration has moved quickly on its plan to send thousands of migrants from the U.S. to the naval base in Guantanamo Bay.
This is not the camps. You're not putting criminals right in camps where ISIS and other criminals. This is a temporary transit.
But the first migrants to arrive there have ended up in that camp complex.
And our co-host Scott Detrow talked with Bill Gates about the current moment in public health.
I will meet with Robert Kennedy. You know, I'm hopeful we can find common ground. I start with an optimistic attitude.
And a look at a beloved American tradition, the football tailgate.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. After days of news about cuts to the United States Agency for International Development, staffers learned that less than 300 people would be exempt from being placed on administrative leave by Friday. That's according to NPR's Jen McLaughlin.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio approved less than half of the requested exemptions for a near agency-wide administrative leave program that will be in effect for the United States Agency for International Development on Friday. That's according to internal emails shared with NPR by multiple sources on the condition of anonymity, fearing further reprisal from the Trump administration. The news comes as staffers around the world report disruptions to life-saving work on health care, poverty, digital sovereignty, and human rights, among other issues. Bureaus in Washington and overseas will be cut drastically. Only 12 people will still be actively working in the Africa Bureau, while the Middle East team will only have 21. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
As President Donald Trump and his advisors, chief among them Elon Musk, continue to take actions to virtually do away with or severely downsize federal government, the question of the power of the purse looms large. While Republicans hold a majority in Congress and have largely been going along with moves by Trump and Musk, NPR's Deidre Walsh says that could change.
There are some places where you could see some cracks in what's really been a really unified Republican Party in Washington deferring to Trump. Federal agencies are going to run out of money on March 14th. Republicans want to put their own stamp on a spending bill so they can protect programs they've helped get for their constituents, things like transportation money or water projects. Mm-hmm. It's unclear what Trump or Musk are going to demand in that spending bill, but Musk has already shown when he inserts himself, he can really influence the process.
NPR's Deidre Walsh. There have already been challenges in the courts as well, with some initiatives placed on hold while arguments continue. In Southern California, LA Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani's former interpreter has been sentenced to 57 months or nearly 5 years in prison. Ipe Mizuhara pleaded guilty last year to bank fraud and false tax charges. Member station LAist McKenna Sievertson has more.
A federal investigation found that Mizuhara took advantage of his friendship with Ohtani by secretly stealing nearly $17 million from the Dodgers MVP. Mizuhara used that money to place bets and cover his gambling debts with an illegal bookmaker in Orange County. Both prosecutors and Major League Baseball have called Ohtani a victim of fraud. Mizuhara is required to pay nearly $17 million in restitution to Ohtani and about $1 million to the IRS, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. He's set to surrender for his prison sentence next month, almost exactly a year since the scandal first shocked the sports world. For NPR News, I'm McKenna Sievertson in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 125 points today. You're listening to NPR. One of the last remaining U.S. industrial conglomerates, Giant Honeywell, says it is planning to split itself into three companies. The company saying today plans to separate its automation and aerospace technology business from its industrial conglomerate. That would follow similar moves by General Electric and Alcoa, which have also split off their businesses. New research based on studying dense crowds at a festival in Pamplona, Spain, has led to a better understanding of how potentially dangerous crowds behave. Bears Regina Barber reports on what they learned.
That's the sound of the first day of the San Fermín Festival in Pamplona, Spain. At noon, around 5,000 people gather in the town square and wave red handkerchiefs. After filming this crowd from rooftops, researchers modeled the movement and it behaved like a fluid. In the past, crowd movements were thought to be chaotic. But Dennis Bartolo and his team broke down the physics of these fluctuations. They found that dense crowds followed recurring predictable patterns.
Because these spontaneous motions are periodic in time, they are very easy to detect. And they are very easy to detect very early on, before they become dangerous.
These results could help authorities monitor if a crowd starts exhibiting this periodic behavior and possibly save lives. Regina Barber, NPR News.
The average interest rate on a 30-year mortgage came down slightly this week, the third straight week of easing. According to mortgage buyer Freddie Mac, rates for a 30-year loan fell to 6.89%, down from 6.95% last week. A year ago at this time, rates were just over 6.6%. Cost of a 15-year mortgage fell to just over 6%. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government. Now playing select cities.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The fork in the road is on hold. We are talking about the Trump administration's offer to federal employees to resign now and keep their pay and benefits through the end of September. Labor unions sued, calling the offer unlawful. And at a hearing in federal court this afternoon, a judge pushed back today's deadline to accept the offer until Monday. For more on all this, we're joined by NPR's Andrea Hsu. Hi there.
Hi.
Andrea, tell us what happened in court today.
Yeah, so it was a virtual hearing in a federal court in Massachusetts, and District Judge George O'Toole started by saying this is going to be quick. He said the court had just received a brief from the defendant, which is the government. So he gave the plaintiffs, you know, the labor unions, until close of business tomorrow to reply. And he said he was pausing the deadline for this resignation offer until Monday, when he'll hold another hearing on the merits of the case. The lawyer for the unions then asked him to order the government to notify everybody about this delay, because the unions worry that people won't know it's been paused and maybe they'll accept, you know, the resignation offer in haste. And O'Toole granted that request as well, and then it was over.
Okay, so about the lawsuit, what have the unions alleged there?
Well, the unions have argued that this whole thing is arbitrary, capricious, and unlawful. And I'll start with the unlawful part. The unions are basically charging that the Office of Personnel Management, which sent out that original email that was titled Fork in the Road, that agency didn't have the authority to offer employees all across the federal government pay and benefits through September. Because, you know, it's Congress that holds the purse strings, and Congress hasn't funded most agencies past the middle of March.
Okay, so that's the unlawful part, but what about the offer is arbitrary and capricious, as you said, according to the union's lawsuit?
Well, for one thing, the unions say the deadline was arbitrarily short. The Trump administration gave people just 9 days to decide whether to end their government careers. And they also pointed to all the conflicting information the administration was sending people about this deal, about what they were actually agreeing to. And one of the union also said the offer didn't consider what would happen if a lot of people just quit all at once. You know, after all, federal workers do things like process Social Security checks and make sure our drugs are safe and keep track of international threats. And I met someone yesterday at a rally outside the Labor Department who brought this up. His name is Otis Johnson. He's with the American Federation of Government Employees. That's one of the unions that brought the lawsuit. And here's what he said.
If they start getting rid of all of these federal employees, it will affect the American public, because they won't be able to get the services that they truly need to continue with their day-to-day lives as well.
And Johnson told me, you know, everything that's been happening, the fork offer, the layoffs that have been threatened if not enough people resign, and Elon Musk's government efficiency team going into agencies, he says it just feels like a hijacking.
None of us have seen anything like this. They're coming in and disrupting the lives of civil servants that have been doing this job for years.
Andrea, what can you tell us about how many people have accepted this offer at this point?
Yeah, well, last night we were told it was more than 40,000, which is roughly 2% of the federal workforce. And today the administration said agencies will still be able to process those offers to resign. But at the end of the day, you know, there are people who see this as a pretty good option, even with the risks. You know, some of these people are retirement age. And by the way, 5% of the federal workforce is 65 or older. And some of them, maybe they're working remotely and they don't or can't return to an office. It is a really personal choice at the end of the day.
Of course. Well, now that this resignation offer is on pause, what has been the response from the Trump administration?
Well, the White House released a statement saying we are grateful to the judge for extending the deadline so more federal workers can take the administration up on what they called a very generous once-in-a-lifetime offer. And they've been insisting this whole time that the offer is legal. They've made the argument that nothing in the program requires congressional approval. Now, attorneys I've talked to disagree with that, but we'll just have to see what Judge O'Toole decides after he hears the case on Monday.
That is NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It is a precarious time for global health efforts and for the United States' role in those global health efforts. The Trump administration has ground to a halt the work being done by the United States Agency for International Development. Its nominees for key health positions have raised questions and skepticism about global vaccination efforts. So when Bill Gates came by NPR to discuss his new memoir, I also asked him about this current moment in public health. That is because Gates is one of the most important players in the world on global health and vaccination efforts due to the work his Gates Foundation has done over the past few decades. And we should note, the foundation has also provided financial support to NPR. I began by asking Gates what he makes of Trump's attack on USAID.
Well, I'm still very hopeful that work that's been done on, say, HIV or polio eradication, that will be preserved. And, you know, right now we need to, even if USAID is going to be slimmed down somewhat and not do climate things and some other things, the basic humanitarian and health work, including the HIV, is a big part of that. In talking to the people in the government, including President Trump himself, and say, no, even if we make it somewhat more efficient, this fits your value system. This fits morality, geopolitics, and if we innovate, we eventually can cure AIDS. So let's stay the course on what's called PEPFAR.
So you're optimistic that funding will turn on again, because as of right now, it's just been, the spigot has been turned off, and Trump and Elon Musk and others are saying pretty disparaging things about.
Yeah, we're in a scary transition state right now. So, you know, even if USAID is going to be slimmed down, it's a fantastic organization. These people agree to work in the field and they need to be out there. The fact we stop mothers from giving their babies HIV that has been so magnificent, and it's so tragic if we stop that. The people in the field and the people at that headquarters are a necessary part of it. And so we need to get those people engaged and maintain their jobs, their morale, even if we're going to slim down and get rid of a few aspects that percentage-wise aren't more than 10 or 15%.
Of course, the other big area that the Gates Foundation has really made its mark is the world of global vaccines. As we talk, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has cleared a Senate committee. He's awaiting a final Senate confirmation vote, but he looks on track to be Health and Human Services Secretary. He's attacked your work. He's attacked you personally. He's questioned vaccines in a way that really worries experts. What do you see as the path forward for the world that cares about vaccinations, given this reality?
Well, it's hard to overstate how miraculous vaccination is. I mean, the reason we're down from 10 million childhood deaths a year to below 5 million a year, the biggest reason is that we rolled out new vaccines, rotavirus, pneumococcus, quite a few. And there's an incredible pipeline of vaccines, a TB vaccine, HIV, malaria. So I'm, you know, excited about that pipeline. I will meet with Robert Kennedy and work to find common ground. You know, I think...
Is there a meeting on the books, or is that just you're happy to meet with him?
No, there's no specific one, but I have 4 days later this month where I'm coming back into town, thinking that the key people will be in place, Secretary Rubio, Secretary Kennedy, you know, NIH, FDA, you know, all the people that the Gates Foundation has partnered with throughout every administration. And, you know, I'm hopeful we can find common ground. I start with an optimistic attitude.
Kennedy talked about vaccines a lot differently in his confirmation hearing than he has in the past. What did you make of those statements?
You know, I don't think he's going to do anything precipitous against vaccines. I'll be very interested in what he goes after, because the immune system and the research around it turns out to be important, not just for HIV, but you know, we now have cancer vaccines coming that the U.S. will want to lead on that. And you know, we have ways of doing gene editing that things like sickle cell cure and HIV can be done. So I hope to get him excited about the pipeline. You know, when Gates Foundation does innovation, we have to do very low-cost innovation because we want it to work in all countries. And that often can save massive healthcare costs, even in the richest countries. So, you know, I know he'll have some interest in that pipeline.
I think it's pretty clear you're a data guy. What are the metrics you'll be looking at to see if vaccine progress, all the progress you just laid out, is backsliding or moving forward or staying on the same pace?
Well, there's NIH research money will be a big part of that. There's the funding for the Global Alliance for Vaccines, where the U.S. is about 20% of all the money, very similar to the Gates Foundation and the U.K. government. Those are the three biggest funders that buys inexpensive vaccines for all the world's children. And so we have a five-year fundraising for Gavi coming up in the spring. And, you know, we'll look to the U.S. commitment to maintain the incredible generosity that's saved millions of lives.
That's Bill Gates. You can tune into All Things Considered this weekend to hear a conversation about how, as a teenager, Gates snuck out of his bedroom in the middle of the night to write code, and how in the process he helped create the modern computing world we all live in.
Even the big companies, particularly IBM, didn't see what we saw. So you always, when you have lots of companies, you have to find a flaw in their thinking.
That's on Saturday on All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration has moved quickly on its plan to send as many as 30,000 migrants from the United States to the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Deported migrants have already landed there. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has details on who they are and where they are being held exactly. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so how many migrants are there already at this point?
At least one plane load of 10 people so far, and Defense Department photos are circulating of a second plane load that arrived today. All members of a Venezuelan organized crime group called Tren de Aragua. The U.S. government has labeled it a transnational criminal organization and is also trying to get it designated a foreign terrorist organization. The Trump administration calls these men high-threat illegal aliens. And Homeland Security, Elsa, posted photos of what it says of them in handcuffs and gray sweatsuits boarding a military plane in Texas to head to Guantanamo. Some have prominent face and neck tattoos that can be a signifier of gang membership.
Okay, and now that they are at Guantanamo, where are they being housed?
The government says they're in a military prison that used to house foreign terror suspects like Al-Qaeda. There is another military prison at Guantanamo that currently does house alleged terrorists and convicts. That's where, for example, the alleged 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, has been for almost two decades. But the government says deported migrants are not being held alongside people like KSM. It says the migrants are in a previously vacant part of a prison.
Prison. Okay, but didn't the Trump administration say that these migrants would be held in a separate detention facility?
Yes, it did say that. It says Guantanamo is meant to be a short-term stopover until these migrants are shipped elsewhere, and that it would do a massive expansion of a detention facility at Guantanamo that has been used for decades to hold migrants picked up at sea. That detention facility is different than the military prison area. And here's what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said last week about where deported migrants would be housed.
This is not the camps. You're not putting criminals right in camps where ISIS and other criminals. This is a temporary transit where we can plus up thousands and tens of thousands if necessary to humanely move illegals out of our country where they do not belong back to the countries where they came from in proper process.
But Elsa, the first migrants to have arrived at Gitmo have ended up in that prison camp complex, even if not in a cell with some Al-Qaeda fighter.
Wow. What do you think the chances are that these deported migrants end up being held at Guantanamo for years and years?
The Trump administration says that is not the intention, but it has not said what length of time it considers temporary. This actually came up when Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem went on Meet the Press last weekend. The host asked her this.
Is it possible, Madam Secretary, that people could be held at Guantanamo Bay indefinitely?
That is not the plan. The plan is to have a process that we follow that's laid out in law and make sure that we're dealing with these individuals appropriately. But it is an asset that we have that we fully intend to utilize.
Elsa, I've talked to several lawyers, though, who worry that holding migrants at Guantanamo could become the same kind of long-term legal morass that holding foreign terror suspects there has turned into. And also, by the way, Secretary Noem is scheduled to visit Gitmo tomorrow.
That is NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Thank you so much, Sasha.
You're welcome.
When the Philadelphia Eagles take on the Kansas City Chiefs in the Super Bowl this Sunday, a third of the country may be watching. Football is one of the few things that can bring people together in this divided nation. And there is nothing like that uniquely American tradition, the tailgate. NPR's Frank Langfitt dropped in on one for the Eagles a couple weeks ago, ahead of the last big game between the Birds and the Super Bowl.
The parking lots outside Lincoln Financial Field this recent Sunday were like a carnival. People tossing footballs, grilling. There's this guy pressing oranges for drinks on the back of his pickup.
Birds all day, baby!
Superfan Jamie Paille wears a green mohawk and face paint. he's certain the Birds will beat the Washington Commanders today.
We go into the Super Bowl! Yeah!
Of course, no Eagles tailgate would be complete without cheesesteaks.
In this case, at least 30 to 40 pounds worth.
Ed Callahan, I'm a retired naval officer, live in Philadelphia.
This is Ed's tailgate. He's got a huge RV, his crew serves breakfast, an omelet with Philly cream cheese, and those cheesesteaks for lunch. Today, he'll feed about 100 people.
How long have you been doing this, Ed?
This is our 21st season doing this here.
And who's paying for all of this? And do you charge money?
No, we don't charge money. This is all hospitality.
Meaning core tailgate members pitch in. Callahan spent about $5,000 out of his pocket this season.
How many of these people do you know?
Probably about half of them. But the rest are friends of friends.
One of those friends is Kenny Justice.
Well, I was born into this. I've been coming to my uncles and my next door neighbor and my friends since I was 5 or 6. Football in Philadelphia isn't just a game. It's all this.
Justice sees tailgating as an escape with friends and strangers, filled with joy and a shared love for the Eagles.
There's nothing like this in the world. I own a business. I have to be professional all week. Yeah, you're dealing with your family. I'm a father. But then you get to come down here, and you get to act like you're a crazy kindergartner. For myself, I'm 59. Ed's like 104, I think.
Ed is actually 78. It's easy to dismiss tailgate culture. But here's the part of our story where we step away from the fun for just a moment and talk to an expert about what all this really means. Tanya Williams-Bradford at the University of California, Irvine, has studied tailgating for years. She sees it as a kind of Thanksgiving outdoors.
What's really fascinating about the tailgate is that we bring the home to the outside. And why do we do that? It's because we're welcoming others in to our experience. And there's no better way to do that than to set up a living room or a lounge area and a kitchen right there outside of the stadium.
And Bradford says tailgating provides something many people are missing these days.
People are investing thousands of dollars to do this over the course of a season. And what they get out of it is community. We're living in an age where people may not know their next door neighbor, but these teams bring folks together in ways that is not easily replicated.
It's also about family and tradition. Back at the tailgate, Kenny Justice introduces me to his son, Roman, who's 14.
I have watched many games forever, and my dad, he kind of forced it down my throat, but in like the friendly way.
Roman says the games are an opportunity to bond with his dad.
My best memory is kind of recent, actually. It's when Saquon Barkley hurdled the dude backwards.
Barkley is the Eagles star running back. On one play, he spun around and hurdled a defender backwards, one of the year's biggest highlights.
It was crazy to watch, everyone crazy, and my dad looked at each other like, it's awesome.
Kenny Justice says the tailgate also allows people to look past their differences, if only for a few hours.
I got friends here who I've known for years. I have no idea who they voted for. I don't care. This tailgate in particular, everybody's welcome.
As Callahan puts it, on this Sunday morning, there's only one party. The Green Party. Frank Langford, NPR News, South Philadelphia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The price of eggs is soaring as farmers kill chickens.
Egg farmers are in the fight of their lives to keep this disease at bay.
Yet somehow the market for chicken wings is fine.
And really, they're just a great group social food.
The mystery of the chicken and the egg on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. The U.S. has a new ambassador for children's books.
It's a lofty title, yeah. You know, the shorthand that I've been saying is it is like the poet laureate of children's books.
We meet Mac Barnett, the national ambassador for young people's literature, after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Justice Department has fired the first salvo in the Trump administration's effort to enforce its immigration policy, suing the state of Illinois, Cook County, and the city of Chicago over their sanctuary city policies that make it harder for federal immigration authorities to arrest and deport migrants. So far, ICE officials have made about 14,000 arrests since President Trump returned to the White House. Border Czar Tom Homan says sanctuary city policies are a threat to public safety.
I would love to arrest a bad guy in a city or county jail, but in sanctuary cities, we don't have access. So they're going to release a public safety threat back into the community, which I think is foolish. Puts the community at risk, puts our officers at risk, and puts the alien at risk.
Chicago, San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles are among more than 170 sanctuary cities and counties in the U.S. In Seattle, a federal judge has issued a nationwide injunction blocking the Trump administration's attempt to restrict birthright citizenship. NPR's Martin Costi tells us it's the broadest court order yet against Trump's action, and it came with stern words from the judge.
On Wednesday, a federal judge in Maryland issued a preliminary injunction against Trump's order to withhold citizenship from children born to mothers in the country illegally. But now federal judge John Kuhnauer in Seattle has signed an even broader order, which also recognizes the interests of the states that have sued over this. The judge called Trump's executive order unconstitutional.
There are moments in the world's history when people look back and ask, where were the lawyers? Where were the judges? In these moments, the rule of law becomes especially vulnerable. I refuse to let that beacon go dark today.
Some Trump supporters have accused the judge of bias. The state attorneys general who brought the suit welcomed the injunction and predicted it's headed for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
This is NPR. Five former heads of the U.S. Agency for International Development are pushing back against efforts to weaken the agency. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports.
Both Republican and Democratic heads of USAID wrote a letter saying to, quote, weaken or even destroy the agency is to the benefit of neither political party and the detriment of all Americans. Andrew Natsios is one of the signees. He ran USAID under President George W. Bush. He says halting foreign aid is happening at a precarious moment as the U.S. competes with Russia, China, Iran for influence.
We just lost the battle. It's not because we were fighting and we lost. We took our troops and we went home. That's what we did.
Now he agrees with Trump that government spending is at crisis levels, and he does not think every foreign aid program is perfect. But he says cutting all of USAID is cutting muscle, not fat. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
The Trump administration's ongoing immigration raids have frightened migrant farm workers here in California's Central Valley, where more than 40% of the nation's fruits, nuts, and other foods are grown. The sheriff in San Joaquin County has been telling farm workers not to worry because in California, police cannot legally take part in ICE raids or assist agencies in arresting migrants. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Justice Department today sued the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois over sanctuary laws that limit cooperation with immigration authorities. It is likely the first of many federal lawsuits targeting cities and states that the Trump administration says are blocking immigration officers from doing their jobs. Both Chicago and Illinois are vowing to defend those laws. They argue that they help to build trust with immigrant communities. NPR's Joel Rose is following this, and he joins me now. Hi there.
Hello.
So, Joel, start with this. What is Trump's Justice Department arguing?
The lawsuit accuses Chicago, the state of Illinois, and Cook County of, quote, deliberately impeding, unquote, federal immigration enforcement, which the DOJ contends has resulted in, quote, countless criminals, unquote, being released into Chicago who should have been held and deported. The lawsuit names both Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker in their official capacities. Governor Pritzker today vowed to defend that law in court, saying it has, quote, always been compliant with federal law and still is today.
Tell us a little bit more, if you can, about these sanctuary laws that are on the books in Chicago as well as the state of Illinois. What do they say?
Yeah, both the city and the state have these laws that limit how much they cooperate with federal immigration authorities. Chicago has what it calls a welcoming city ordinance that goes back to 2012 that prevents police from assisting in immigration enforcement or even asking about a person's immigration status in most cases. The Illinois Trust Act was signed in 2017 by a former Republican governor, by the way. Among other things, it prohibits law enforcement in the state from holding someone in custody just because of a request from federal immigration authorities. These laws do make some exceptions for serious crimes and criminal warrants. You know, and they're similar to sanctuary laws in many cities and states, which argue that cooperating with immigration and customs enforcement would undermine trust with immigrant communities because those communities would be less likely to come forward and to report crimes.
Right. And as many people may recall, the first Trump administration did try to punish sanctuary cities with similar lawsuits. Remind us how that played out.
Yes, we have very much seen this before. This lawsuit today is similar to another case against the state of California that the Department of Justice brought back in 2018. Justice Department lawyers back then argued that the state's sanctuary law violated the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which gives the federal government clear authority over immigration laws. But California fought that lawsuit and won. They argued that the federal government cannot force local law enforcement to actively assist ICE under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which courts have generally understood to block the federal government from telling states how to manage their police forces. In other words, local police can't interfere with federal law enforcement, but courts have said that simply withholding their cooperation is a very different thing.
Joel, didn't the Justice Department also try to withhold funding from sanctuary cities in Trump's first term?
Yes, including Chicago, actually, and the Department of Justice lost in many of those cases, too, though I should say not in all of them.
Right.
The second Trump administration is once again threatening to withhold funds. Attorney General Pam Bondi signed a memo just yesterday, her first day on the job, directing the department to end funding to sanctuary jurisdictions.
Okay, last thing. Why go after sanctuary cities so hard again? Why does this seem to matter so much to the Trump administration?
It may be because these laws are a major obstacle to President Trump's pledge to carry out mass deportations. ICE simply has limited capacity to make arrests and detain people, and officers much prefer to arrest immigrants who are already being held in local jails. That is easier and faster and often safer than arresting people out on the street. And in fact, this is how ICE was able to make so many arrests during the Obama administration, for example, before sanctuary laws were as widespread as they are now. These laws force ICE to spend more time and energy making its own arrests, which is especially inconvenient for the agency now that the White House is pushing to get those arrest numbers up in order to follow through on the president's campaign promises.
NPR's Joel Rose, thank you.
You're welcome.
Some hospitals across the country have been canceling appointments for transgender kids. The reason? President Trump signed an executive order saying that any institution providing the care would be cut off from federal funding. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, LGBTQ rights groups say that Trump cannot do that.
Kristen Chapman spent months trying to get an appointment for her transgender daughter, Willow, at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia. It was scheduled for January 29th.
Just a few hours before our appointment, VCU told us they would not be able to provide Willow with care.
Chapman had already moved her family from Tennessee, which has a state gender-affirming care ban for youth. About half of states across the country do. On Tuesday, the ACLU and Lambda Legal sued to block the executive order on behalf of several plaintiffs, including Chapman, who spoke to reporters on a press call.
I thought Virginia would be a safe place for me and my daughter. Instead, I am heartbroken, tired, and scared.
ACLU senior counsel Joshua Block, who was also on the call, says Congress has passed laws prohibiting health centers from discriminating against patients on the basis of sex.
Congress said don't discriminate, and President Trump is saying you have to discriminate.
On Wednesday, 15 attorneys general, including from California, Maine, and Wisconsin, issued a statement warning hospitals they must not cancel appointments or they'll be violating state anti-discrimination laws. There were also protests at several hospitals that canceled appointments, although it was a mixed picture. Even within the same city, some places continued to offer care. The American Hospital Association told NPR they are not providing guidance to hospitals right now about how to navigate this. Terry Schilling is president of the American Principles Project, which has spent years urging states and the federal government to limit access to what he calls sex trait modification procedures.
I think this is fantastic what President Trump has done to protect children in this country. I think it's got a little bit more to play out.
He says all eyes are on the Supreme Court, which is set to rule in the coming months on whether a state gender-affirming care ban constitutes sex discrimination. And he says Congress needs to pass a ban on this care for young people into law.
We have to get votes in Congress. We have to hold senators and members of Congress accountable for these procedures.
Kate Iyer is a professor of law at Rutgers. She says with this executive order, the president is trying to attach new conditions to federal grants to hospitals and clinics.
The president doesn't have any unilateral authority to do this.
In ordinary times, she says, hospitals could simply take an order like this to court and trust they would win. Still, there is a lot of uncertainty about how the courts and Congress are going to respond to this order, and federal funding could theoretically be cut off to hospitals.
So that really does put regulated entities in a predicament.
The ACLU lawsuit is asking the court for a temporary restraining order while the legal process plays out. In the meantime, hospitals and clinics are making their best guesses on how to proceed, and families and trans young people are waiting. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
President Trump floated two stunning ideas about Gaza this week. For one,
the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it.
He also said that the entire population of Gaza would be relocated to other countries. We dig into what this could mean on our daily podcast, Consider This, from the team behind All Things Considered. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Jesse Eisenberg plays characters who spend a lot of time grappling with anxiety. That includes his role as David in his latest movie, A Real Pain, which he also wrote and directed. The movie has been nominated for 2 Oscars. Eisenberg talked with wild card host Rachel Martin about what his anxiety looks like in real life.
What's something you thought was normal about your childhood that you now realize was unusual?
What did I think was normal?
you know, I mean, I was, I mean, but I don't want to like, sounds like I'm asking for pity. I was like a miserable, miserable kid. I was like, I mean, I had great parents. I was a miserable kid for some reason. And I thought it was like normal to, that we're all terrified of all things. And now I take my kid to school, you know, which I did 2 hours ago, and they run right into the building smiling. And the first like time that happened, I was like, what is going on? How do they not know what's inside for them? And so I keep like, as a parent, like waiting for like the shoe to drop and reality to hit that actually life is miserable and going to school is miserable. And they just haven't felt that yet. And it's been, I would say, like overall, like an unbelievably revelatory experience watching my kid go to school in a different way than I did.
Has watching your kid not suffer from the same kind of anxiety that you did, has that lessened any current or existing anxiety that still travels with you into adulthood?
No, I think I'm too old to like change. So I'm still like continuously mystified as to like, you know, people who seem to like walk through the world like with their head held high. I don't understand it. In fact, I asked ChatGPT this morning, do you think if I had more circumstantially difficult life experiences, if I'd be more confident asking for a bagel? And ChatGPT said, well, actually, there is a trove of academic evidence to support what you're saying, which is like, you know, growth through trauma, et cetera. So this is like kind of what I'm obsessed about. ChatGPT is a you know, great place to go for these very, you know, human questions.
Oh, that hadn't occurred to me. That actually is useful. So it's not that you need validation from artificial intelligence about what you're feeling, but it gives you resources. It basically gives you footnotes.
Yeah. So I got a bagel this morning and I felt too nervous to ask something about the bagel. And then I had this thought, which was that I wonder if I had something more objectively horrifying happen in my life, I'd be much more comfortable asking about the bagel. And so I said, is there any like literature to support this kind of thing? And it said, yes, there are theories about growth through trauma, which means like that, you know, if you experience something traumatic, you're working on growth in a way that maybe makes you less conscious about these kind of smaller little petty things.
Yeah.
Little did the bagel know it was part of a discussion
this
with a computer.
Poor little unsuspecting everything bagel. Was it everything? Yeah. What was it?
It was pumpernickel everything. And my initial question was, is pumpernickel healthier than eating a plain bagel? And then I was thinking, oh, I could ask the people behind the counter. But no, it's a grab-and-go fast New York place. They don't want to answer this kind of question. And so then I went to ChatGPT and I said, do you think if I suffered an objective trauma, I would have asked if the pumpernickel was healthier? And it said, yeah, maybe. What a dumb life. A dumb, dumb life.
Jesse Eisenberg's new movie is A Real Pain. You can hear more of that conversation on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year. Offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his main goal in the war in Gaza was to eliminate Hamas, the group that launched a deadly attack 16 months ago. Israel included Gaza's police force as a target. But as NPR correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai and producer Anis Baba in Gaza report, following a ceasefire, Gaza's police are now back on the streets.
This is the sound of life in Gaza these days, without the terrifying boom of deadly Israeli airstrikes. Instead, the mundane sound of traffic police fills the streets. Here's Anis Baba describing the scene.
This is the whistle of the traffic police in Khan Yunis city after the deployment for the first time ever in the streets of Khan Yunis while they are wearing their official uniform. You can see that the police here is totally ready. They are in every roundabout, in every junction.
This humdrum scene in most corners of the world is anything but in Gaza. That's because police were targeted by Israel in the war. The police say more than 1,400 officers were killed out of a force of around 9,000 before the war. What their presence on the streets now means depends on who you ask. Ahmed Al-Attar was an accountant in Gaza, but he became an armed merchant during the war, selling contraband cigarettes. He says he was forced to carry a gun and hand grenades to protect himself from armed gangs robbing people and stealing food aid off UN trucks. But now, he says he doesn't even carry a small blade on him, just cash. That's because police are back on the streets in full uniform. Like other people in Gaza NPR spoke to for this story, Al-Attar praises the local police force and says he supports their ongoing crackdown on looters. Israel says it was the police that were stealing aid in order to benefit Hamas and acknowledges targeting them across Gaza. Their rank or whether they had direct ties with Hamas seemed to make little difference. Lieutenant Colonel Haytham Hamdan is the deputy police chief for Burej in central Gaza. He says his home was targeted by Israeli airstrikes, killing his father, brother, and aunt. He says around 100 police officers were killed in Israeli attacks in just Burej alone. But he says neither he nor the police force follow Hamas or any Palestinian faction. Hamdan says the Palestinian police come from all corners of society. Naomi Newman, a visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says Israel sees the police force in Gaza as an arm of Hamas that helps it stay in power. She was the head of the research unit at the Israeli intelligence agency Shin Bet. I asked her what she makes of Gaza's police on the streets again.
It say only one thing, that Hamas still have a foothold in Gaza Strip.
Hamas militants have also appeared on the streets since the ceasefire. Here's Newman again.
We need to show the people that Hamas is not the solution, and this didn't happen.
She says Israel destroyed much of the group's fighting capabilities and killed its senior leadership, but not its influence in Gaza. The spokesman for Gaza's police, Colonel Mohammed Abdel Nasser Al-Zarqa, says they're a civil institution that has nothing to do with Hamas's militant wing. There's also a dividing line between their work and that of another branch of Gaza's interior ministry, the feared internal security force known as Al-Amn al-Dakhli, that goes after Hamas critics and people collaborating with Israel. Al-Zarqa says his officers worked throughout the war in plain clothes, helping families reunite with lost kids, distributing aid in schools where people sheltered, and resolving disputes. Independent political analyst Riham Aouda from Gaza says policemen who were targeted by Israel are needed now, no matter who governs the territory.
Because you can't leave the strip empty without any security.
And while there are people in Gaza who don't support Hamas, the return of the police appears to have broad public support. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anis Baba in Gaza.
The United States has a new ambassador, not to a country, but for children's books. Mac Barnett has been named the Library of Congress's National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Now, what exactly does the job entail, and what does Barnett plan to do from his post? NPR's Andrew Limbong spoke with him to find out.
Here's how Mac Barnett describes the gig.
It's a lofty title, yeah. You know, the shorthand that I've been saying is it is like the poet laureate of children's books.
I don't know if that's necessarily shorthand, but essentially the job is to promote books and reading to kids across the country. Everyone who gets the job does it a little differently, and Barnett's focus will be on picture books.
The picture book is my favorite art form. I started out, I was a camp counselor in college, and reading picture books out loud to kids, that is what made me want to start writing books for them. It's just such an incredible, vibrant, exciting, forward-looking, experimental art form, and I think it's really undervalued, too.
Barnett is the author of dozens of books for young people, some novels, some graphic novels, and yes, some picture books, including his popular Shapes trilogy, which has its own series on Apple TV+. But the picture book, he says, doesn't get the same respect as those other forms, which he finds, frankly, offensive.
I'm not offended because it's dismissing my work. It's because we're dismissing kids. And if we think that children's books are anything less than real literature, it's because we think kids are something less than real people. And if we believe they are real people, then they deserve good art.
And Barnett argues that good art for kids should be held as highly in our culture as any other literature.
You're saying like you'd put like Llama Llama Red Pajama up against Great Gatsby.
I would put Frog and
Toad. I don't mean that kind of, I don't mean that.
I would put Frog and Toad up against Great Gatsby. In the Night Kitchen?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Where the Wild Things Are. Freight Train. I think Goodnight Moon is one of the great pieces of American literature of the 20th century.
Of course, this is an argument for the adults. In a lot of ways, convincing kids to pick up a book over a phone or an iPad is harder now than ever. But while us grown-ups worry about declining literacy rates and reading test scores, Barnett says he doesn't think about kids as future adults. He thinks about them as readers now.
We're never going to win the argument that you should read a book because it's good for you. This isn't why kids read. It's our job to make books that kids want to read. And what we're talking about there is not a book as an educational tool or some vector for a lesson that an adult wants to impose upon a kid. Like, the subject of children's literature is life itself. This is art for children.
And a part of showing kids that art is to let them lead the way.
Growing up, my mom would take me to the library every week, and she would let me pick out whatever books I wanted to read. Whatever I pulled off the shelf, that was going to go in our checkout bag. It doesn't mean that she agreed with every book. My mom is a very opinionated woman, in addition to being a very funny woman. And if she didn't like what I was reading, she would talk to me about it.
At his acceptance speech this morning, Barnett said, "It's not an accident that picture books are so experimental, because childhood is experimental." Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
And I walked in the water in my cargo top. My hands in the water in my cargo top. And if I get a little bit of whatever I got, Lordy Lord, Lordy Lord, hey, 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 Lord, I say hey, Lordy Lord, Lord, little wine, little men, way on, gone away, way on, and you don't draw no pay, mighty wise men, you don't draw no pay, let the big egg won't come and take the pill away, yes, he will, Lord.